acceptance of one another, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. All of these are part of our principles, and they're probably more familiar to you. But the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process? Why do the principles of a religious organization contain a phrase about a political system anyhow, you might ask, and why are we exploring this today? And the second part of this question is easy. It's because of our annual auction, which will be held in this room on Saturday, March 23rd at 6 p.m. I hope you'll all be here. One of the items is the right to choose a topic for one of my sermons. And last year, Kathy Hahn brought it, and she chose part of our fifth principle. Here are the questions she asked me to address. Are there times when the democratic process doesn't yield a just or right result? Would basic civil rights have come about if left to the democratic process? If the democratic process doesn't provide the result we're committed to in our congregation, what do we do? If it doesn't within society at large, what do we do? I'm pretty sure I can't answer all those questions in detail in the next 20 minutes, but I'll try. We'll start by examining the question of why a statement about a political system is in our UU principles to begin with. Those of you who know me were probably wondering how I'd work in a bit of history. Democracy, as Miles just told us, the democratic process itself, simply means a government where legally defined citizens have power through their ability to vote, often by electing representatives. Presumably, this form of government will allow at least some of the common people, its citizens, to determine the course of the government, rather than only a king or a dictator or some such person. In a direct democracy, each citizen or member votes directly on the issue at hand. Our annual meeting is a good example of that. In a representational democracy, such as the city of Rutland or the U.S. government, citizens elect representatives who carry out the functions of the government, and our kids know that. Theoretically, those voting will be informed in their choices. They'll make choices based on facts and things that they have explored, and not just emotion. And theoretically, those elected will consider issues still more carefully and understand them still more deeply and make wise and well-informed decisions for the benefit of those who elected them. We use the democratic system here in our church. Only official members can vote at our annual meeting, which will be on May 5th. And each vote has equal weight. The majority vote determines how we proceed on issues and who our elected leaders will be, and we trust them to make wise decisions on our behalf. But why is the use of the democratic process included in our principles? Because of history. Remember, our Unitarian and Universalist roots go back several centuries, mid-1500s. As do those of our country, those are a little bit later, but not a lot. Back to a time when the idea that individuals had a voice in governmental or religious decisions was almost laughable. There were kings and popes, lords and governors and bishops, and they made the decisions, not the ordinary people. Kings, for example, could say to the people, and they did in England in particular, we're going to get rid of the Catholic Church and go to this, and you all have to do that too, or we'll throw you in jail or chop off your head. There were other people who had influence, but they were appointed for the most part, or they were wealthy, or they held hereditary positions. They weren't elected by the citizens at large. And then through the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, things changed. The Protestant Revolution, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the U.S. Constitution, all of these are examples of individuals demanding more say in their government and in their churches, attacking and breaking down absolute hierarchies in both institutions, and they really reinforced each other. The development of democracy was part of the general elevation of reason and logic over emotionalism. It was assumed that citizens, which were originally white male landowners in our country, were drawn to facts and unemotional analysis, and so they would make reasoned, objective decisions as they voted, considering the findings of experts in science and economics and other fields. Citizens were increasingly literate, and it was assumed that that would help them be more informed, and they wanted to help to shape their own destinies. Over time, the definition of citizen, and therefore voter, was expanded, including people of color, including women. There was some question as to who it included in terms of those who had official citizenship. There was a time when you didn't need to be a U.S. citizen in order to vote in some local elections or even state elections. Still, it was assumed that these citizens, whoever they were, would make decisions based on reason and logic and analysis. After all, democracy itself is a product of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. And here in our own country, some of our founding fathers argued for a very strong federal government, even a monarchy, as they had in England. Others insisted on a more egalitarian system and were deeply concerned about individual rights. They agreed that some organized religion or government was needed, but it should be small or local. There were all sorts of questions over who would rule and how they would be chosen, how money could be raised, and who would make decisions about the people. Our country's organizing document, the Articles of Confederation, felt really short in many areas of answering those questions, and so slowly work began on a new constitution, and democracy was born in this country. Two houses, the Senate with equal representation from each state, and the House with representation based on population. You probably remember a lot of this stuff from high school history classes. Members of each were elected by the citizens, as three branches, each with different powers and checks and balances, and a whole litany of things. Underlying all of this was a strong belief that many voices needed to be heard. The common people were part of the government and its decisions, at least indirectly. Our system, however brilliant or flawed it is, attempts to hear each voice at every level. In the words of Winston Churchill, no one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms. The Bill of Rights was added 4 years later, after the Constitution was ratified, guaranteeing a variety of individual and states' rights, establishing that the voices of individuals and the rights of individuals would be recognized. Our country's forebears tried, however imperfectly, to guarantee that a wide diversity of opinions would be heard and considered. And so did our religious forebears. When Universalist churches gathered to organize in 1790, they created a declaration of faith, a creed which churches are very familiar with. But at the end of it, they included a truly radical thing known as the Liberty Clause. It read, "Neither this nor any other statement shall be imposed as a creedal test, provided that the faith thought indicated be professed." In other words, you could be wrong without strictly adhering to a party line. You had to be in general agreement, but you could have your own versions of what the truth was. You could have a different opinion, your own religious understanding, and you could speak it. We find resonances of this in our fourth principle, which affirms the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, and in the first part of the fifth, which affirms the right of conscience. The Unitarian side of our heritage focused on the differences between congregations. It avoided the word denomination intentionally, which had echoes of religions in which correct doctrine and practice is determined by a few at the top. Even when they first met, they declared themselves to be the American Unitarian Association, an association of autonomous and independent self-governing congregations. Its bylaws, set in 1825, stated that it recognizes that its constituency is congregational in polity. And polity just means how a church organizes itself. And that individual freedom of belief is inherent in the Unitarian tradition. Democracy. Each church has a right to its own voice and its own practice. And within each church, each member has a voice. Each of our churches owns its own property, raises and manages its own money, and can ordain its own minister. This is a radical departure from most denominations, including even the Universalists, Universalist state conventions usually held title to individual church properties, and they had the power of ordination, not the individual churches. In most denominations still, or many at least, the leadership determines policies about social issues. And open or closed churches without regard to local parishioners, even chooses priests or ministers and can move them around at will. We UUs own our own buildings and are responsible for their upkeep, which is different from, say, a Catholic church. In order to sell a church building or expand it or buy a new one, each member of our church has a vote. One of the things that was a huge issue when I was in the Melrose Church is that there were two Catholic churches in Melrose and one in the next town over. And the diocese had announced that the three were going to combine, and they would choose which of the staff to keep. And there was a huge uproar. But in fact, the members of those parishes had no say in the matter. We take on, as Unitarian Universalists, we each independently choose to take on potentially controversial stands. This church voted thoughtfully to support the Refugee Resettlement Initiative a few years ago. Each of our churches makes such decisions itself democratically. Many other religions' organizing structures are not democracies, but Unitarian Universalists are emphatically democratic. And our fifth principle reminds us of that. One final bit of history. At the time of the merger in 1961, the name chosen was the Unitarian Universalist Association. We say we're a denomination, but technically we're not. That word association is a reminder that we are an association of independent churches, each responsible for itself. The UUA's bylaws include these words. Nothing in these bylaws shall be construed in any way as infringing upon the congregational polity or internal self-government of member societies, including the exclusive right to call and ordain its own minister and control its own property and funds. We take those for granted, but they're actually pretty unique. And the UUA's corporate purpose? To affirm, defend, and promote the supreme worth of every human personality, the dignity of man, which has been expanded now, and the use of the democratic process in human relationships. That phrase again, the concept of the democratic process, affirming the value of each voice, each individual person, each individual congregation, is deeply woven in our UU roots. It's no accident that many of the people, mostly men, who were key to founding our country in the 18th century were also key people in the founding of American Universalist and especially Unitarian faiths. Benjamin Rush, Joseph Priestley, John Adams, Ethan Allen, John Quincy Adams, and others. The democratic roots of our country and our UU faith are deeply intertwined. Both resist authoritarian rule and express a confidence that ordinary citizens are people of integrity, capable of reason and wise decisions. Our democratic practice sets us apart from other religions. A brief aside before we get to Kathy's questions. There is continuing debate still about how effectively our association is a democracy. Many people strongly support the UUA's openly advocating for gay marriage a few decades back, but encouraging its clergy to do the same. Or it's raising the issues of white privilege and racism in recent years. Others feel that these institutional stances are too much like power from on high, and they strongly resist any sense that our denominational leadership might be trying to tell individual churches, or even worse, individual UUs, how to believe. Democracy is still not easy. Now, to Kathy's four questions. The first one. Are there times when democracy doesn't yield a just or right result? It's a complicated question because defining what a just result is depends on who you are and what you believe and where your priorities lie. But I would say unequivocally, yes. Whatever you believe and however you want to be, there will be times when decisions don't seem just to you. The question of what's right or what's just is the issue. An example, I believe strongly in a woman's right to choose whether or not to bear a child. To me, this means safe, reliable birth control available inexpensively to all people of reproductive age. It means abortion needs to be accessible and expensive, requiring only the woman's permission and performing in surroundings that meet the same conditions as those that offer other medical procedures at similar risk. I also know that in this democracy, there are those who believe just as strongly as I do, but they believe the opposite way. They believe that few, if any, pregnancies should ever be terminated. Now, I will admit that I think such a belief is hypocritical and medically unwise and based on dreadful ideas about women and the purpose of sex itself. But that doesn't change the fact that in a democracy, other people are entitled to believe very differently from me. And they're entitled to a voice and a vote, too. Sometimes their view will win out over mine, and I'll be certain justice has not been done, and I will be mightily upset, and I am. What's more, when my view prevails, there are those who hold a different view than mine, and they will also feel that justice has not been done, and they'll be just as upset too. So yes, I would say on all sides, it is inevitable that in a democracy, in our church, our city, or our country, there will be times when it seems that democracy is not giving a just result, or at least not the way that I might define justice. I would say that each of us should feel this way from time to time. No one faction or political party or committee or individual or viewpoint, even mine, should automatically carry each and every vote or set the policy. I believe there always will be and always should be a diversity of opinions about what's right and just, and no one opinion should always win. The next question, would basic civil rights have come about if left to the democratic process? And again, I'd probably say a qualified yes, but not always in... a straight line, or with ease, and not irrevocably. Democracy relies on people making wise and informed choices about who to elect. It also assumes that those who are elected will use facts in making their decisions and consider the good of the whole above their own preferences. Democracy arose in a climate that emphasized the use of reason and science and was suspicious of overly emotional responses. And it presumes that personal feelings can be set aside, that facts will be valued and the good of all, and that change is possible in light of new facts. Over time, democratic institutions have made such changes, expanding who's defined as a citizen, for example. Things can and do change in a democracy. They go back and forth. Policies have been set and laws passed that both protect our environment and attack it. Affirmative action has been both championed and undermined. Overall, I believe civil rights are in much better shape than they were 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, and democracy has certainly been part of that process. I also believe that civil rights can slip backward, even slip away, as we've recently witnessed. Progress is not inevitable. It's often hard won, and it can be lost. One of the sobering realities of the past few years is its reminder that even after a right has been long affirmed or a program funded for decades, supporters need to keep advocating for it, keep educating on why it's important, and not just assume that it's permanent and relax into complacency. Which takes me to Kathy's last two questions. If the democratic process doesn't provide the result we're committed to in our congregation, what do we do? And if it doesn't within society at large, what do we do? The quick answer is to vote, obviously. Stay involved in the political process, raise our voices, invest our money and time and energy in what we believe. Get involved in organizations that support new values, those that challenge racism or advocate for environmental responsibility or a host of other issues. One way to do this might be to attend the Global Student Climate Strike, organized by 350.org, which will be held on our lawn at noon on March 15th. But a much deeper answer, if there is any answer, It's a lot more complicated than that, especially in a time when it seems so many of the things that we use hold dear are under attack. I have been struck and deeply troubled by the observations of William Davies in his books Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. Davies is an English political economist, and his book has two central themes. The first is an exploration of how the idea of expertise came about in the 16th and 17th centuries, and how severely expertise has come under attack recently. Science and factual data, whether it's about climate change or border security or economics or a host of other things, facts and reason, which are the underlying assumptions of informed voting and wise governmental policy, have often been ignored or not or outright dismissed. And while there is always some level of pendulum swing in policies, there are issues, particularly around the environment, where a change in policy at some future time may not be able to move the pendulum back to being healthy. Davies' second point is that especially with the use of the internet and tweets and YouTube, fear, often caused by ignoring the facts and even creating alternative facts, has become a major force in political decisions. He feels harnessing emotions and physical instincts for political purposes, feelings of nostalgia or resentment, anger and fear, have disrupted and changed the status quo. I would say two things. The first is that those of us who value facts and science need to keep insisting that those be considered, and we need to keep doing that over time, not wait until it's already drifted. And we need to do this even when it feels like the powers that be are ignoring or discounting them. We need to continue to do this in support of decisions we agree with and not see that they're etched in stone. The right of conscience reminds us that we cannot be silent, we cannot be complacent. The second thing I will say is that we who have more liberal values will need to find a way to include this trend toward emotion in our arguments in healthy ways. We also need to realize that we can't turn back the clock. Twitter and YouTube will not go away, even when the current administration does. Information and misinformation flows almost instantaneously over the internet, and that will not change. People who whip up crowds through fear and anger and even falsehoods are not new, and while the faces may change, that won't disappear. We will need, as religious liberals, to be careful not to fall for news that enforces our beliefs without question, and we'll need to not automatically disregard facts that we don't like. I have been stunned in the last couple of days at reading articles actually in scientific magazines saying it's time possibly to reconsider nuclear power. And part of me goes, are you out of your minds? But perhaps there are reasons to go back and revisit things, and that's difficult for us. We'll need to become much more savvy in our use of media. We'll need to figure out how to present facts in ways that catch people's emotions, in ways that connect with their minds and their hearts. And we'll need to question our assumptions about how information is perceived and utilized. I close with a very short story from Earl Holtz, Ascending the Fifth Principle. He writes, a Revolutionary War soldier described the difference between a monarchy and a democracy in an analogy to a three-masted sailing ship and a raft. The sailing ship, monarchy, is beautiful and impressive on the high seas, he said, but in rough water, it can be shattered and sink on the shoals. The raft of democracy, on the other hand, is virtually unsinkable. It's exposed, and you'll always have your feet wet. The raft of democracy is messy and not easy to steer. It won't always go where you want it to, especially if others are trying to steer in opposite directions. Democracy is uncertain and sometimes unpredictable and often uncomfortable. But it's what we have as a church and as a country. May we be willing to keep getting our feet wet. Amen. We'll ponder for a minute or so and then we'll offer responses.